Archbishop Vincent Nichols, let's think back first of all to October 1978, to your memories of the election of Pope John Paul II. You were just a young priest, weren't you, in the Liverpool Archdiocese. What are your memories of that occasion?
Well, I think two phrases come to mind immediately. One was the great phrase, a pope from a far country. And he was, for the first time in so many centuries, there was a non-Italian pope. And secondly, the unforgettable first appearance of John Paul, who I didn't know, and his words of do not be afraid. Do not be afraid to open your life to Christ, to open a public sphere, to open culture to Christ, because Christ is the one who knows the truth of our humanity. So it was this sense of almost formidable strength and confidence that appeared in this man whose face was full of character, and you thought, oh my, something's going to happen now.
What kind of reaction do you remember within the church in England and Wales, particularly up there in Liverpool? As you say, he was quite an unknown character, wasn't he?
I think that's true. I think what was also important at the time was Archbishop Warlock spoke out very quickly, and he had worked alongside Karol Wojtyła, and so was able immediately to begin to interpret this rather startling event for us. And I did so, obviously, very positively and with a real sense that he was a man who was a profound philosopher. He was a man of great spiritual depth and someone who had played a very active and committed part in the Second Vatican Council and was clearly going to see that continue and develop.
It was clear quite early on that ecumenism was going to be one of his particular passions, one of his priorities. How important was all that to your work, to the work of the church in the UK?
Well, there are so many aspects of John Paul's pontificate that have been important to us. Clearly, his visit in 1982 was central to the impact that he had in our country. And there he gave such confidence and vigour to the Catholic community. Because it was a visit to the Catholic community. In a way, the rest of the country watched. Unlike the visit of Pope Benedict, which was a state visit, John Paul came to the Catholic community, celebrated the sacraments in all of our big cities, and he gave a huge boost to the self-confidence of the Catholic Church in England and Wales. And he did so with not just vigour and panache, but also great openness. So the ecumenical moments, particularly at Canterbury Cathedral, were unforgettable, as has been the visit of Pope Benedict. But I think also what he helped us to understand was that Europe didn't stop in the West. And John Paul had this great openness to Central and Eastern Europe. And after all, one of his first actions as pontiff was to go to the tomb of Cyril and Methodius and to pray for reconciliation between East and West, something which he didn't achieve. But I think it's on the move more now, and there is greater rapprochement now with Moscow and Rome in ecclesiastical terms than would probably have ever been possible with John Paul II, but he laid those foundations too.
What about some personal memories, your own contact with him? What would you say was the most striking of those?
Well, I think the most striking characteristic that I picked from him, as it were, as a personal quality, was his sense of humour. At the end of one of the synods, I was waiting to be invited for a meal with the Pope, because in the course of a synod, he would have every bishop to a meal. And I thought, this is going to go wrong, because in my pocket I had a ticket for a home match of Lazio. And would you believe, the day I was invited to lunch with the Pope was the day I could have gone to the Stadio Olimpico. And I was sitting next to the Pope, so I said to him, Holy Father, I said, I had a ticket for Lazio's football match this afternoon, but I've come here instead. And he turned to me and he smiled and he said, you chose well. And he was forever teasing people and really did have a sense of humour and a sense of fun.
Of course, his own sportsmanship would have helped him to understand your passion to be at the stadium at the same time.
I think that's true. There was another occasion in another synod when the benches at the front of the aula for the cardinals were largely empty. It was a Wednesday morning, and I think some of the Roman cardinals in particular thought the Pope mightn't turn up, so they hadn't. But at the break, he tapped on the microphone and he said in Latin, he said, as my old philosophy tutor used to say, I can see the absentees. So he put them in his place. And then at the meal, at the end of the synod, he looked around the room and he said, ha-ha, I can see there are no absentees today. So he did have this sense of fun and readiness to tease people, yeah.
In 1991, he appointed you as the auxiliary in Westminster, didn't he, at the time, the youngest bishop in the UK. What would you say was his legacy to you as a leader, now the leader of the church in England and Wales?
I think the words that he first spoke, as I say, of do not be afraid, echoed right through his whole life, from his youth and right through his ministry as a bishop and then as his ministry as the Pope. And I think that that will be the thing that stays with me, that he was a man who was not afraid because he was close to the Lord. And I think sometimes I'm probably in need of that inspiration to be a little more confident that what God wants will be clear and that it's my job just to get on and say it and do as best I can without too much prevarication.
Sometimes he's criticised for being so concerned with the church's outreach, this huge figure on the world stage, that he failed to deal with pressing problems of church governance at home, and particularly, of course, the sex abuse crisis that was unfolding during his pontificate. What do you say to those criticisms?
Well, I think what we've come to Rome for is to celebrate his beatification. And his beatification is a sign of his holiness. And there is a real distinction between holiness and management. So beatification is not a medal for good management, but it's a declaration that somebody was close to God and is exemplary for us in our attempts to live that first and most important duty of trying to stay close to the Lord. So I think they're the perspectives in which we have to judge this moment and understand this moment and accept it as a great gift for the church. It's not a rounded judgment of history on the papacy. It's a declaration of somebody's personal holiness.
There will undoubtedly be calls for his canonization. The Santo Subito, I imagine, will continue. Do you think that would be a good idea to, again, push ahead with that?
I think these things are literally in the hands of God. It's not we who produce a miracle. It's God who produces a miracle. And if that's what happens, then I would be entirely trusting of the processes of the church. Whether it takes 10 years or 100 years, it doesn't really matter. But I'd be surprised if it's as long as 100 years, because Pope John Paul is a person to whom people turn, is a person in whom people trust their prayers, and is a person, as we've already seen, at whose intercession God will work a miracle.
How is the beatification being celebrated back home in Westminster, in England overall? Do you think it's been somewhat eclipsed in the lead-up by the royal wedding? When I was there a week ago, there was wall-to-wall coverage of the royal couple and not a sight of a picture of the Pope anywhere, apart from outside the Catholic media, obviously.
Well, I think that's true. We have been very taken up with the royal wedding, which was an absolutely wonderful event, and an event which shows that despite many other voices, there is a profound Christian instinct alive in English society. But I think what our job is to see the connection between the two events. You know, the wedding is the promise of a man to a woman of the gift of love, born out of their appreciation of each other and giving rise to great hope. John Paul's papacy was born out of love for the Lord and gives rise to great hope. And so in a way, these are two sides of the one coin of God's love. But I think over the next few days, attention will now turn to the beatification of John Paul II, because he is held with affection and high esteem by many people in England. There will be great events of celebration shortly after the beatification. There are a number of pastoral letters, I know, being issued by bishops on Sunday afternoon in Westminster Cathedral. It'll be packed inside and out for a re-showing of the beatification mass on big screens. And so we will seize the moment once we've recovered from the wonders of the royal wedding.
You yourself were responsible for the commentary for the BBC, weren't you, during Pope John Paul's funeral back in 2005. How would you say perhaps the coverage will compare between the beatification and the funeral?
I think there won't be any comparison. The funeral of Pope John Paul II was an immense world event. I think it was the one event that drew together more leaders of states and governments than any other event in human history. And clearly there was that huge crowd which came to Rome in between his death and the funeral, millions and millions of people. So that was a very formal, a very historic moment. This, in a sense, is more a moment of pure faith. And that's more difficult to interpret in a largely secular society. So I think the funeral will remain a moment of unique importance. And certainly for the broadcasters, that will be the case. But I think the influence of Pope John Paul, as seen and expressed in his beatification, will continue. It might not be a peak media event, but it will be a steady light that will continue to give hope to people.